As many people know, this past Shabbos across the community was Shabbos dedicated to the 25th Yahrzeit of the Rav. As things would have it, you know, the fact that the Rav passed away on Chol Hamoed Pesach actually has made what would normally be very large Yahrzeit commemoration somewhat smaller. People tend to be away for Pesach. So it was actually a very wise decision, I thought, on the part of Yeshiva University to make sure to do it a few weeks before to ensure that people would be able to participate. 25 years is obviously a very long time, and given that the Rav unfortunately was ill over the last decade or so of his life, it's really been many, many years since the Rav's impact was most directly felt in our community, and yet what Chazal would have called the demus diyakno. Chazal used that expression that even when Yosef was not in Yaakov's physical presence, he saw Yaakov's visage, and that really had an impact on his behavior at a critical juncture in his life. So the demus diyakno of the Rav continues to impact in various ways. So I wanted to obviously. The Rav in his incredible complexity and sophistication, you can't be distilled down to a few minutes, but I wanted to just make a presentation on the basis of something that Rav Lichtenstein wrote regarding a critical juncture in the Rav's life, and used the three things that the Rav identified as a kind of a window into who he was, and especially with an eye towards, like, what does this mean for us today as members of our community. There's a little bit of biography, which I think is largely familiar to people here. The Rav spent his formative years immersed in the Talmudic study with his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and to a lesser extent with his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, also known as Rav Chaim of Brisk, who was the one who revolutionized the study of Talmud and was able to develop his own methodology, which relied heavily on not just analysis, but classification and categorization. So instead of just saying, okay, the halacha dictates that you're supposed to do X, or the halacha dictates you're supposed to do Y, the idea is to sort of get to the deeper level and say, and therefore the halacha should be X or Y. So this requires a great degree of creativity and analytical prowess. So the Rav spent, basically the first 15 years of his educational life just totally immersed in this. So that by his early 20s, he was recognized as having sovereign mastery over not just all of the traditional sources, but of his grandfather and by extension his father's methodology. And at that point he goes to the Free University in Warsaw and he begins to study political science. Then he goes and he does a doctorate in Berlin where he meets his wife. And he comes to these shores in December 1932. Originally he was supposed to take a position in Chicago. It was the Great Depression. So, as many rabbis find, he lost his job before they even gave it to him. So, he stopped in Boston, and the first 10 years in Boston were very, very difficult for the Rav. His great accomplishment, we'll get back to this during that time, was founding the Maimonides School. There were very, very, very few observant Jews to begin with. The Rav, in decades later, would refer to the Boston that he arrived in as a midbar. That was the term that he used to like to use to describe it. He was also, he got involved in kashrus then, kashrus now, tends to be an adversarial kind of an industry, and he wanted to raise standards and stop the abuse of the shochtim that was going on, and he was subjected to the most vile forms of attack brought to court. There's actually a very remarkable passage where I think it was a federal judge ruling in clearing Rabbi Soloveitchik of any wrongdoing. He was basically framed by various business interests. Said, not only has he not committed any wrongdoing, but this is the person of greatest integrity that I think I've ever come across in my judicial experience. In 1941, his father, Rav Moshe, passes away, and he's sort of hired on a very temporary or interim basis by the Board of Trustees of Yeshiva University, sort of to give him a tryout as, to see how he can do. And he writes this famous letter basically saying that, if I'm not that good at it, I wouldn't want the job anyway. So, and the rest is, of course, history. And for the next 45 years, he becomes the towering figure of American Orthodoxy. For many people, in his sophistication, his ability to synthesize traditional Torah learning with a very deep grounding in the world around him, we'll come back to that point, he's able to preserve Orthodoxy, which at that time was just being decimated. People who had been raised observant were leaving, not, you know, in a trickle, but in a deluge. And it was easy to understand why. These were perceived as European traditions and work in America. And the Rav was able to make a sophisticated and full-throated argument on behalf of Orthodoxy in a way that very few people could. I would say actually nobody else really could. The time point that I want to focus on is the years 1959 and 1960. 1959, the Rav's reputation is such that Ben-Gurion offers the Rav to become the chief rabbi, chief Ashkenazic rabbi of the State of Israel. Technically speaking, there's supposed to be an election involved in that, but Ben-Gurion tells the Rav that, he says, don't worry, I can take care of the election for you. And the Rav says, no thanks, and that's why. That wasn't the Rav's idea of integrity. He wouldn't want to be beholden to anybody. The Rav was only in Israel once in 1935 when things were very rough in the early years in Boston, so he tried out to be the Ashkenazic rabbi of Tel Aviv and lost, so just in case anybody, you know, here loses a rabbinic contest, you know, you're in good company. So in 1960, the Rav developed stomach cancer, and stomach cancer is a serious disease today, let alone then. And did not think that he was going to make it. Prior to his operation to have the tumor resected, he called over his three children, his eldest daughter, Atara, and then Tova, and his son, Chaim, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, an eminent Jewish historian, and said that he would stake his claim to Olam Haba on three things. And it's really these three things that I want to try to develop as key points of the Rav's approach. He said, number one, it's interesting, none of the three are being the Gadol Hador, or, you know, that was not his claim to Olam Haba, you know, that he didn't think of as warranting, you know, and that itself tells you something about his approach.
Did he view himself as a Gadol Hador?
Well, I mean, he was a very self-effacing and at times, modest person, but yes, he was no fool. He towered above his peers. And that's not to say that he didn't have great respect for people like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who were considered the posek of the generation, and Rav Aaron Cutler. These people all knew each other from Europe, and they were actually all, in one way or another, distant relatives. The Rav's mother was a Feinstein, was a Prujaner Feinstein. So in any event, he had great respect for his contemporaries and his colleagues on that level. But yeah, he certainly was aware of his position. Not to say that he was arrogant about it. Far from it. So he says, number one, he would tell the Almighty that he founded the Maimonides school. Now, what does this really mean? So in Boston in the 1930s, so there were no day schools. There were barely any day schools, if at all, in the United States of America. In fact, the idea was considered effectively unpatriotic. If you read Seth Farber did his dissertation on this particular topic, the founding of Maimonides School, because to withdraw from the public school system, seen as, you know, what is this? It's one thing to go to Talmud Torah afterwards, but to say that we're going to have our separate system of education was not just, you know, when we're talking about the tuition or whatever, it was seen as un-American. But the Rav's idea that you needed to nurture Jewish children in an environment where they would be exposed to Talmud Torah. Now, obviously, it wasn't the kind of immersive Talmud Torah that the Rav experienced. He didn't have formal education. He learned informally. He learned with his father all day. He didn't have a 40-minute period of Gemara. That's not how you produce somebody like the Rav. But point is that Jewish education. And this for him was what he called the 14th Ani Mamin, that Torah can and must thrive in any society, in any generation. And his founding of the Maimonides School, and so many schools around the country that modeled that. One of them in the neighborhood is Frisch. Frisch was when Rabbi Meir founded Frisch. He just literally took the model of Maimonides and transported it. So much of Jewish education in this country is based on the vision of the Maimonides School, which was to provide a Torah education that would train people to be functionally observant members of Jewish society, and to give them a general education that was second to none. And so many of the Maimonides graduates went on to Harvard and to Radcliffe and many of the finest programs in the country. And this wasn't just, you know, somehow a concession, but the Rav understood two things. Number one, he understood the value of general studies as enriching one's avodat Hashem. And number two, he understood that if Orthodoxy was going to survive, it couldn't be a secluded enclave, and that you would need people to be sophisticated, to be trained at the highest levels. We take it for granted today that you could have dual curriculum schools, but let's just appreciate the opposition that the Rav faced at the time. How difficult it was. The first campus was in Roxbury. When the Jewish community moved out of Roxbury, the Jewish community historically in Boston was in Roxbury and Dorchester and Mattapan. When the Jewish community moved towards Brookline, of course, the campus moved with it. So that's really what the Maimonides School itself represented. So that was his first claim to Olam Haba. And the second claim to Olam Haba he said he would make is that he learned with his children, which tells you really two things. Number one, when the Torah discusses the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, there are two different psukim that are used. One of them is Vishinantan Levanacha, the other one is Limata Mosam Espenechem. In both contexts, it's understood rabbinically to mean that you teach your students, but its primary meaning is your actual biological children. This was a tradition in Brisk. Brisk was always very reluctant to outsource education. There's a Gemara in Masachas Bava Basra and Daf Chaf Aleph, which tells a story that people's parents were no longer able to teach them. So there's a man named Rabbi Yeshua ben Gamla, who was a Kohen Gadol during the period of Bayis Sheni, who said, well, we need to develop a system of education that's going to allow people whose parents are not in a position to educate them to educate them. There's a very fascinating series of developments that Gemara describes. The Briskers were always very reluctant to outsource this, based on the Rambam's presentation, but also based on a concept that the parent-child relationship expresses itself in a teaching relationship. So he learned with his children. So that's number one. The emphasis on education in the home was very important. The Rav wrote a very famous essay, The Hesped for the Talmud Rebbetzin, where he develops the idea that both mother and father have a critically important and equal role to play in the development of the child. Shema b'ni Musar avicha, al titosh torati mecha. And he spoke about, he spoke in perhaps what you might say are hyperbolic terms, but he said, without my mother, I would have been a soulless, dry being. In other words, for all of his father's erudition, that his mother gave him a certain sense of what Yahadut could be and what it should be. And so he felt that both parents had a major educational role to play. That's number one. Number two is, you know, by powers of higher mathematics, as I mentioned before, two of his three children were girls, and he learned intensively with them, Gemara. And this is, of course, a major part of the Rav's legacy as well. Everybody here knows that in the Maimonides School, the Gemara classes, both my in-laws attended the Maimonides School, the Gemara classes were co-educational. Originally, Maimonides was going to be a boys' school. They had problems with enrollment, but be that as it may, once it was determined that it would be co-educational, the Rav insisted the classes not be separated, that the curriculum be the same, and he learned with his daughters very intensively Gemara. And the Rav felt, just as he felt, that in general, people needed to have a sophisticated understanding of both Torah and the world. So the Rav was a true pioneer in the realm of Talmud Torah L'Nashim. Yes?
So that's what he felt, that they should learn, Hebrew studies and also general studies.
Right, in Maimonides.
Right. So why is it that way of thinking in the Hasidim in Brooklyn. They feel that they just feel that it should just be
Mudei
Kodesh. Yeah, so there's a whole...
And they don't know...
But they never really accepted.
Yeah, so there's a whole... Yeah, well, that's for sure. There's a whole rabbinic literature based on a passage in the Talmud, in Masechta Sota, where it says, Rabbi Eliezer, that a person who teaches his daughter Torah... It's hard to understand exactly what Torah means. The Rambam says it's a reference to Torah Shebaal Peh, as opposed to the Torah Shebichtav. But be that as it may, a person who teaches his daughter Torah is Kilu Malamda Tiflis. Tiflis is also a very hard term to define. Sort of something like nonsense, or maybe even licentiousness, or something, you know, something untoward. Now, it doesn't say that it's actually Aser, though you might get the idea that it was a bad idea to do something that was licentious. But the Rav understood... and here he was following to a degree the precedent of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim gave his approval in a very fascinating way to the development of the Beis Yaakov movement, where the Chafetz Chaim makes the argument that however you understand that line in the Gemara Masechta Sota, that was when young Jewish women could be educated at home. But in our generation, where that's no longer the reality, by the way, the crisis of observance of Eastern European Jewry followed World War I. World War II was decimation, destruction of European Jewry, but religious decimation was following World War I. So this is the centennial year of Beis Yaakov. So the Chafetz Chaim said that obviously it was a big mitzvah to teach girls Torah in a formal educational structure. So now what the Chafetz Chaim did not go so far as to say that they should understand it at the highest level. They should learn Gemara in depth. And in that respect, the Rav was a true pioneer. And you can ask Rabbi Adler, who was there at the time, when the Rav goes down to Stern College in 1974 to deliver the first high-level Gemara Shir. If the Rav is giving a Gemara Shir, it's by definition a high-level Gemara Shir, so it's a redundant, but he gave it on the first parak of Masechta Pesachim, which is called Or L'Arba Asar. Rabbi Adler at the time discussed with the Rav, why are you going yourself? Somebody else can do this. And he said, they're going to attack me. I can defend myself, my Talmidim cannot. So he understood very well what the controversies would be, but he felt that this was truly imperative to the moment, especially in a society in which women would be able to develop sophistication in all other areas. To say that you're not going to be able to develop a sophisticated approach to Torah was something that the Rav felt was to the detriment of Judaism writ large, and to the women in specific. So that's the second major legacy that the Rav said. You know, I learned Torah with my children. Again, his children, two or three of them being girls. I take that as an opportunity to reflect on his legacy in that respect. Now, third and finally, the Rav said, again, just before the stomach cancer operation, going back to the hospital here. So he said to Atara, Tova, and Chaim, he said, the third thing was that he supported an almana, that he would tell God that he should let him into Olam Haba because he supported an almana. Happens to be that we know who the almana was, it doesn't really matter for now, but that there was a particular almana, she lived in New York, whose husband had been a major Talmud Chacham in Europe, and she would have otherwise basically been destitute. And the Rav basically financed her, took care of her. He collected money for her. And just an interesting comment, right? I mean, there is a big mitzvah. The Torah in Parshas Mishpatim says that taking care of the yatom and the almana are very important mitzvahs. Kol almana v'yatom lo ta'anun. And surely that's an... But for the Rav, say, to stake his claim, you know, to Olam Haba, and that is a very fascinating comment. But it's actually very much in line with things that the Rav wrote about constantly. If one goes through the Rav's philosophical writings, Lonely Man of Faith, community, confrontation, majesty and humility, these are just a few that come to mind right away. The Rav felt very deeply about the sanctity of the individual, that each individual, and of course that in this respect he was basing his comments on Chazal, where Chazal say famously in the Gemara Baba Basra and Daf Tes that anybody who saves one life is as if he saved an entire world. Because we understand that every person is irreplaceable by virtue of the fact that everybody is created B'Tselem Elokim. So that means that human life is the arch value. So if he said, I sustained one almana, but that's enough, that should be something that gets me into Olam Haba. That wasn't just an offhanded comment, but the way that I've come to understand it over the years is the sanctity of the individual. And one person is never too small. And the Rav, in many of his public positions that would be received as completely shocking today, especially as it regarded conflicts between individual and the state, the Rav always sided with the individual because he felt that the individual, you know, the state is a conglomerate, but the individual is a basic unit that the Torah and halacha respect. So just to give you two examples, which would be perceived of, I can't imagine it, you know, if somebody got up and said them today, you know, they'd be pilloried. But the Rav, just to give two examples from the modern state of Israel, very famously, in 1967, Milchemet Sheish HaYamim, we returned not only to Yerushalayim, to the Ir Atika, but also to Yehuda and Shomron, and the Golan and Sinai. And the Rav's position, as he articulated it, was when he was questioned, you know, would it be permissible to return land? The Israeli government did not annex any of the territories that it captured in 1967, with the exception of Yerushalayim, in the hope of coming to some land for peace deal. So all of the Gedolim were asked, would it be permissible to return, in theory, land for peace? And the Rav said quite simply, Pikuach Nefesh is Docha, as Kola Torah Kula, that saving lives is the most important value in Judaism. So he said, not if I, a rabbi, but if the generals determine that this will save Jewish lives, that they can come to a lasting peace, so then he said, of course, it would be within the bailiwick of the generals to decide that, much like we go to the doctor, when halacha looks to the doctor as an expert in the terms of determining, is this person, let's say, sick enough that we need to violate Shabbos? If the doctor says yes, we don't ask any further questions about that. So the Rav's position was, and he literally said this, that he would return the Kotel HaMaravi if it would save one Jewish chayal. So you just have to understand and appreciate where the Rav was coming from in this regard, the sanctity of each person's life. Number two, it wasn't just Jewish life, but many people here in the room will remember in 1982 there was a massacre in Lebanon in two refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila. What happened was is that the Yeshuvim of the Galil were being bombarded, and Sahal went out on a mission called Sheleg, Mivtza Sheleg, Shlom HaGalil, 1982, now called the First Lebanon War. It was in 2006 we had the Second Lebanon War. And so Israel had captured up until the Litani River, which is basically 40 kilometers north of the boundary, and then pressed on to Beirut, which was itself a very controversial thing. And while Israel was the military authority in that area, Lebanon, which is a country divided between Christians and Muslims, so the Christian Lebanese are called the Phalangists, so the Phalangists went into Sabra and Shatila with Israeli soldiers all around and massacred, I don't know exactly how many, I don't think anybody does, but let's say 1,000 men, women, and children in these refugee camps. And the Rav, who did not grow up with Zionism, the Rav came to Zionism after the Shoah, the Rav threatened to resign from the Mizrahi unless a formal commission of inquiry was established. Now, by the way, a formal commission of inquiry was established. And what kind of makes this remarkable is, of course, the Rav's sensitivity to what he perceived as completely unacceptable loss of human life. Rav Lichtenstein very famously published an essay at that time in a prominent Israeli newspaper, more or less calling for the same. But the prime minister at the time, as you'll recall, was Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin was a close friend of the Rav. Menachem Begin's father had been the Gabbai in Brisk, where the Rav's grandfather was the rabbi. So, you know, they went way back. And yet the Rav was very principled in this regard. And what military operations, they're important, but everything has to be done in proportion. And his sensitivity to human life per se, to the almana that he supported, to save one chayal, And then finally, you know, his position in 1982, which was one of the last public positions that he takes, because by 1985 he becomes no longer really able to function in public, and then he passes away in 1993. So the Rav's legacy really reflects the idea of the sanctity of individual life. There are many, many Piskei Halacha that time does not permit, we're already over time, to get us to get into right now. But again, how careful and sensitive the Rav was to individual life. I'd like to just conclude with one thought on this point, which we know the Rav had an incredibly flexible mind. I mentioned before the Rav's valuing general education. The Rav did not come from a family that took a neutral position in general education. Reb Chaim was a vociferous opponent of general studies. And the Rav Zionism, so that too, it wasn't as if he came from a neutral family on Zionism. Reb Chaim was an anti-Zionist. Very famously, Reb Chaim made a takana in Brisk when Herzl passed away that nobody should be maspid Herzl in any of the Batei Knesset in Brisk. I mentioned Menachem Begin's father before. Menachem Begin's father gave a hesped for Herzl in Brisk, and Reb Chaim confronted him about it afterwards, and he said, you know, I said nobody should do this. And he says, yes, of course, you know, the Rav said that nobody should be maspid Herzl in any of the Batei Knesset in Brisk. I think there were 12 shuls in Brisk. And he said, I founded a new shul so that I could be maspid. So he said, your takana was only chal on the existing Batei Knesset. So he could learn a little bit also. But anyway, the Rav was very flexible of mind. So two of his major, major positions, Zionism, general education, were contra the family tradition. But in essence, he always revered his forebears and very much saw himself, despite these major differences in policy that he came to, always saw himself as a continuation of Reb Chaim. So there's a very famous story about Reb Chaim that I think is apropos and even to a degree illuminating about the Rav's point of view about the sanctity of human life, one Jewish life, taking priority almost over anything else. There's a story, and again, if it's apocryphal, then I apologize, but there's a very famous story that there had been some pogrom, and a particular Jew came into the Beit Midrash in Brisk, otherwise known as the Beis Medrash, and said to Reb Chaim, you know, if we only knew that it was the Chavale Mashiach, the rabbinic tradition that there will be the birth pangs of the Messiah before the Messiah comes, based on Psukim and the Navi Zechariah. So if we knew that the Messiah was coming, so then we could feel okay about what was transpiring, because at least we would know it was for some greater purpose. And Reb Chaim went crazy. He became incensed and enraged, and he said, who are you to say that the Bias HaMashiach is more important than one Jewish life, to somehow justify the blood that's shed because Yemos HaMashiach are coming? Where do you get that idea? So again, I think Rav, in this respect, was reflecting the idea, you know, that he had of Reb Chaim. Another story that highlights a point: we know that Pikuach Nefesh is Dochas Kol HaTorah Kula, and then when it comes to a person who's ill on Shabbos, and there's even a question, it's not a definite that this person has a Cholish Yesh Bo Sakana, that the life is in danger, but even if you have a question about that, so you're Mechal Shabbos, you treat it like a Tuesday. You can look at the language of the Rambam. So Reb Chaim and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father and grandfather, were in a room, and the doctor was there, and there's an individual who was a chola, and Reb Chaim asked the doctor if he needed more light to see and to examine the patient as to what was going on. And the doctor said, yes, that would actually be helpful. And so Reb Chaim says to his son Reb Moshe, he says, you know, this is Nisr Daraisa Havara. We just had Parshas Vayakel, Lo Sivaru Esh B'chol Moshe Vasechem Yom HaShabbos. It's one of the 39 Malachos of Shabbos. He says, light the candle. The doctor says it would be helpful to him. And Rav Moshe turns to the doctor and says, are you sure that you really need more light? And Reb Chaim looks at Rav Moshe like he had said something indecent and says to the doctor, I'm sorry, my son is an Am Haaretz.
My son is what?
Because if you really believe, it, you know, as the halacha is, that even a safek sakana is going to be docha Shabbos, so then how could you even hesitate? In fact, the Rambam uses that language in the second parak of Hilchos Shabbos. He uses the language of asur lihitmameya. You're not allowed to even delay. The delay is a violation, even if you save the person's life in the end. So the great sensitivity to human life And the care that was always taken with that is a very important part of the Rav's halachic legacy, and privileging that over other very important values. And Lichtenstein summarized and distilled this for us. It wasn't that we loved Eretz Yisrael any less, but that we loved Am Yisrael perhaps just a little bit more. So like I said, these things would blow people's minds today, you know, and it certainly would never the majority view within Torah circles. The Rav, he never owed anybody a nickel. And as the Pasuk says in Sefer Dvarim, Lo taguru mipnei ish ki amishpat lelokim hu, that a Torah leader cannot be afraid of anybody because he has to do what he thinks is the right thing to do halachically. And the Rav was somebody who throughout his life was attacked from the left, he was attacked from the right, but he held his ground. And so, you know, as we move forward, 25 years after his passing, 35 years since he really was no longer on the scene, everybody tells you that when a new issue comes up, we know what the Rav would say about this. But unless the Rav really spoke about it, you don't know what the Rav would have said about it. So the best way that we can honor his legacy is by trying to the best of our ability to immerse ourselves in Torah as he did, A. B, to be aware in a sophisticated way of society around us, to come to conclusions that can be helpful and properly guide the Jewish people. When it comes to saying this is what the Rav would have done, we're always going to be speculating, but we can honor his legacy by following the methodology that he used and trying as best as we can, lo taguru mipnei ish ki amishpat lelokim hu, not to be fearful of what they'll say from the left or what they'll say from the right. Recognize the stakes are much higher and try very, very hard to do the right thing, even when it's going to incur a great degree of criticism. Yehi zichro baruch.